From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Yet another wild day in D.C., President Trump reportedly livid over efforts to undermine his actions by an anonymous senior member of his administration. Meanwhile, Democratic Senator Cory Booker released classified documents from Brett Kavanaugh's tenure in the Bush White House. Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings continue, and we'll have the latest on both matters right after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Wow. When I think it can't get any wilder, it does. Another remarkable 24 hours in D.C. Good morning. It's good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Right now, a news conference getting underway at the downtown L.A. Federal Building. The U.S. Attorney's Office laying out a criminal complaint against a North Korean accused of carrying out the massive Sony hack, as well as other cyber intrusions. Remember WannaCry 2.0? This individual is alleged to have been an originator of that. We'll have details in our second hour of Air Talk. But first, emotions running still higher at the White House and Senate chambers, where Brett Kavanaugh is being questioned. New Jersey Democrat Cory Booker released an email chain labeled committee confidential. Committee Chair Charles Grassley followed by releasing a tranche of documents labeled confidential. Well, that hasn't stopped each side from hurling accusations against each other. We'll have the latest on the Supreme Court confirmation hearings later this hour. But first, President Trump reportedly enraged over an anonymous New York Times op-ed written by a purported senior member of his administration. The piece describes the lengths to which senior members of the president's team go to protect the country from the president's worst inclinations. The president immediately blasted the messenger and the message.
So if the failing New York Times has an anonymous editorial, can you believe it? Anonymous, meaning gutless, a gutless editorial. So this we're doing a great job. The poll numbers are through the roof. Our poll numbers are great. And guess what? Nobody is going to come close to beating me in 2020 because of what we've done.
The president has gone on to make additional critical comments about the piece. The Times piece portrays the actions of the official as being in service to the country, putting the nation above politics or loyalty to a leader that the writer of the piece sees as amoral and unprincipled. My question for you as an Air Talk listener is, what do you think? Is this morally acceptable, what the individual is doing? Do you believe in the claim that the person is making, that he or she is serving a higher good in from the inside, working against portions of the agenda of President Trump? Do you think that that's morally wrong? The president was elected by the American people, presumably for him to carry out his agenda, and you think it's wrong for someone to take a job in the administration and then work against what the president is trying to enact? Or do you think, as a number of op-ed pieces have said, that it's cowardly for the person to write this op-ed piece, that if he or she wants to raise the alarm about what the president is doing, that person should quit working in the administration and should become a very public, vocal opponent of President Trump's agenda? We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. With me is Sean Walsh. He's Republican political analyst with Wilson Walsh Consulting in San Francisco, former advisor to Governors Pete Wilson and Arnold Schwarzenegger, and former White House staffer for Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush, and Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, former Obama senior advisor in 2018. So, Sean, let me ask you, first of all, what do you think of the morality described here by the anonymous administration official?
Oh, I don't know. I guess the bottom line is if you're unhappy with your boss, you can always quit. The other issue, too, is you can consider yourself a patriot who wants to do good things for the country and make the country move forward, and you may not agree with your boss. Generally, if people feel that way, they usually keep it quiet and they don't put it on the front page of the New York Times. I do believe there's probably a lot of people who've served in for both Republicans and Democrats who had on a number of issues fundamental disagreements with their principal and did what they thought they could do to serve the country and to the extent minimize what they perceived to be as damage. It's just human nature. But that said, this is really unprecedented to have somebody come out and dump on your boss in the New York Times, and the corrosive effect that has is very, very chilling. You know, my question is, what is a senior advisor? So, I mean, is it somebody in the cabinet? Is it somebody who's a deputy assistant to the president? Is somebody who's an assistant to the president? You know, it's unknown. But, you know, it just goes, adds to the continuing freak show that is our current state of affairs at the federal government.
Matt, how do you see it?
I don't even know what you make of this one. There's a lot of problems, I think, with how this came about. Because basically, you know, this is clearly going to feed any more deep state paranoia within the White House. There's no question about it. I mean, how can you be Trump and look at this? And so if you're coming out and saying, okay, I'm somehow serving the country, who is this person? We don't know who this person is. We're supposed to rely on the New York Times saying it's a senior official. So we're supposed to take the word of the New York Times. But why are we taking the word of the New York Times? Like, what does that mean? So you're sort of – and this is an institution that Trump has been bashing. A lot of Republicans and a lot of people in the country are not particularly fond of the New York Times. I like the New York Times as a newspaper. But it's sort of an odd thing to just take the standard. Do we know that this is someone high ranking? There's another piece of this too, which is, well, who's this person to say, like, we're carrying out the resistance? What resistance? Like – are we supposed to trust this person's judgment? That's not the system of government that we have. And no one thinks Donald Trump is more problematic than I do. But this is sort of a really problematic way of going about this. Both the anonymous nature of an op-ed, which we're just supposed to rely on. Well, it's a really senior person and it's a person who's really helping all of us. Well, who is this person? Do we all agree with that person's philosophy? I mean, we have a system of government that elects people for a reason. So I think there's a lot of problematic elements to this, all the way from the press portion of this to who is this person and just, okay, so there's a few people in there leading what resistance. So we can't agree on anything in this country.
Yeah.
So this person's supposed to be telling us which way we're supposed to be going. I think it's problematic for a whole bunch of reasons. And then I think if you really think that you're, quote, resisting or you're stopping the president from his worst instincts, how is this going to help? You got to figure the
White
House.
Why would you go public about it if that's the strategy?
Well, exactly. If you really care, the White House has got to be now. It's got to be a complete paranoid cauldron. Everyone who works there is going to have to even push further for loyalty, for fealty. The president's going to listen even less to some of the people who are around him, which we already know it sounds like some of them have had to push back on some of his worst instincts, independent of what this person is saying. So I don't see how this in any way is politically helpful or good on a whole variety of levels. And I think it was really irresponsible for the New York Times to do this. It's now blown this up as if this is a big deal. But look, this person could be a deputy senior somebody at some department somewhere. So we just don't really know who this is. And even if it is someone high ranking, so what? I mean, we're supposed to follow this person as opposed to the president who was elected. It's problematic for our system.
I think I was hearing that someone could be described as a senior administration official, could apply to like 1,000 people.
It really could. Yeah.
And so the question would be how much are they truly able to work against the president's agenda? But I mean, I realize this is upside down world with this presidency. We're in totally uncharted territory. But Matt, are you at all concerned that with the writing of this and at least if what's there is accurate, that this could open up future administrations for people who are essentially moles to join administrations and to work to undermine the efforts of democratically elected presidents?
Well, this is a problem, right? I mean, like, I have a lot of problems with Trump, and I would love to wax poetic for an entire hour on this. But for all the problems that he has presented, and I think some of the norms and some of the way that he operates is terrible. But, you know, Lyndon Johnson's got us into a war that killed 50, 60,000 Americans and Lord knows how many Vietnamese, basically on a lie. There was a question of what we were getting into the Vietnam War for. Iraq was almost certainly a lie. There was no weapons of mass destruction. How many Iraqis were killed and wiped off the planet for that? My point is, there, you know, we're just running around acting like we're sort of one step away from Stalin's Russia, and I'm not sure that that's serving anybody doing any good. I think Trump's been problematic in a lot of ways. He hasn't gotten hundreds of thousands of Americans killed like they happened in the Civil War when James Buchanan couldn't head it off. So I just think we're so hyperbolic as a society right now in politics. But I just don't see how pulling on this sweater of Donald Trump is particularly helpful, because you're right. This is going to be problematic for future administrations down the line. Why wouldn't they do it for somebody else?
Yeah,
why,
Sean Walsh, do you have that concern?
I do. I think once again, Matt and I are in simpatico. I agree with almost everything he said. We have a system in our government that elects a person as the president of the United States and elects people in Congress. And then we have a system to remove them, which is the next election cycle. With regards to deep state, you know, look, there's always been a deep state. So I've worked in a number of law firms. I was at a law firm, a very, very large global law firm, where my partners were former senior people in the Clinton administration. And so we had a conference that was talking about environmental issues. Some of the people there thought I was a Democrat. It was during the Obama administration. And one of the senior people in the Interior Department told me, well, you know, when George Bush became president, I just kind of buried myself from the bureaucracy and threw sand in the gears and did my best to undermine what he wanted to do. And then when Obama came in, I felt like I could, you know, fully do what I wanted to do to protect the ground squirrel and a couple of other species out here in the West. So I'm telling you that deep state stuff happens both in probably in Republican and Democratic administrations. It happens. To what extent and how much that actually drives policy remains to be seen. But again, if you've got such a fundamental issue with a person who's duly elected, as Matt said, by the people in the United States, and you don't like the issues or you feel that you're smarter or better than the rest of the people who elected him, then it's time for you to go with your ego. And, you know, my question is, I bet this guy who or gal who put this op-ed out, someday they're hoping that 20 years from now they're going to be like Deep Throat and they'll be able to give their name and go down in history as someone who, you know, did this. So I really question the ego or the hubris of the person who actually wrote this this issue. So
Clay in Los Feliz, what do you think? Clay, you there? Nope. Okay, let's go to Brian in the city of Orange. You're on Air Talk.
Right. So I'm having a lot of fun being on both sides of this issue. I agree that this writer was a coward. But also, I'm kind of glad they're there. I'm definitely not a supporter of Trump, so I'm glad they're doing everything they can do. I do think they should speak up and say who they are eventually. In fact, I would say they probably will at some point and try to come out as the hero.
Yeah, just what Sean was saying. Brian, would you have concerns that in future administrations that you might feel supportive of, that individuals would try to do the same thing to undermine a future president?
Well, like one of your guests said, I think it already exists. I think it's already happening. I think it's already there. And somebody is using this opportunity, with as volatile as it is, to actually probably get some political gain. I think they're there, and I think they're trying to become the savior of a system that they're deeply entrenched in.
All right, Brian, I appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jonathan in West Hollywood, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
I don't see where the guy or the woman who did this had any choice. I think that there's definitely a fascist overtone running through the White House right now under normal circumstances. I think there might be things in place that could protect somebody after making such a statement. But with this administration, I don't think so. I think it would be suicide.
I assume you're speaking metaphorically. But Jonathan, why would the person need to write this piece? So let's say you support what she or he did. You think that it's good that they're trying to thwart aspects of Trump's presidency. What's the justification for writing about it?
I think we would have to get further into the details of how off the rails things really are there. If they are, as this person says they are, there may come a point that it would even be impossible for them to do what they did. I think we have to give the New York Times, which is no slouch corporation, a bit of leeway here in assuming that they had to hesitate before saying this was anonymous, but they felt it was necessary to do it.
Yeah, I'm still trying to get at the issue of why what the reason, I mean, what purportedly the writer, how they're portraying their concern is that people shouldn't freak out. Don't worry so much. There are adults in the room. We're mitigating the actions of the president that could be capricious and dangerous to the country. But Matt, you're a Democrat. Do you think that provides any solace?
No, this is not the way our government works. You know what? You know how you check the president? It's called the elections that are coming up in a few in a couple of months. If the president is so off the rails, now we're not talking about, even the article talks about he's not for free trade. Well, that's too bad. He got elected. I don't like his position on trade. I think it's irresponsible. And do I think Trump has a lot of intellectual backing for his stuff? No, we've talked about this for years. I think it's problematic he got elected, but he did get elected. And so we have a mechanism both in terms of a check on the executive branch, which is called the Congress and the courts, which are, by the way, doing their job. And if Democrats take over the Congress, they will operate in whatever manner they're going to operate on. And then you also have, if this guy really is off the rails, like if he's looking to order nuclear strikes, let's say, which was not alleged, but something completely insane, there's a way to remove him. There's impeachment. There's the invoking the 25th Amendment. I mean, this is so bad. Again, I don't know why we're relying on some anonymous person to say, well, I feel better. You, who I don't know who you are, you're making all the right decisions and stopping his worst instincts. If his instincts are that bad or that problematic, then he can be removed. There's many mechanisms to deal with this if it's that bad. If it's not, then you have a job to do within the system that we've set up here that has lasted over 200 years. But just to say that there's a small group of us just doing whatever it is that we feel is appropriate at any given point in time, that would not be accepted under any other presidential circumstances.
We'll continue with Matt Rodriguez, Sean Walsh joining us on Air Talk. We'll take more of your calls back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking about yesterday's publication in the New York Times of an anonymous op-ed purportedly from a senior member of the Trump administration, in which it details the writers and others in the administration's efforts to thwart some of the agenda of President Trump. The piece describes the president as amoral, among other things, unprincipled. We're talking about, first of all, whether those actions as described, whether those are moral and the right thing for someone serving in a presidential administration to undertake. Secondly, if you think it is, do you think it was wise for this individual to write about it? Should the New York Times have even published it? And with that in mind, James Dow, the op-ed editor at the Times, was on the New York Times The Daily speaking about the op-ed. Dow was first approached through an intermediary. He later talked to the author of the piece. Dow says he confirmed the person was a senior official in the Trump administration, and then Dow explains the decision to grant anonymity.
You know, the newsroom grants anonymity to sources on stories when they feel that those people are in danger of physical danger, of losing their livelihood. Mm-hmm. And our rules aren't all that different in opinion. We don't do these very often. I think this is maybe the fourth time we've done it in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. And it was essentially a case of if this person would not be willing to use their real name because they perhaps wanted to remain in the administration to do what they're doing, as they did not want to lose their job or reputation or face whatever other kinds of consequences one might face in this situation.
That's James Dow, the op-ed editor of the New York Times, defending his decision to publish the anonymous piece by what's described as a senior Trump administration official. Nate in Eagle Rock, what do you think?
I have 2 points, Larry. First, I just find it so curious that one of your guests, Matt, thinks it's insane that we should follow the New York Times reporting in this, that we should trust them. I've been trusting the New York Times for 40 years, and my politics completely lie center left. But the New York Times is not the National Enquirer. And I find it strange that this whistleblower, besides any other whistleblower in this administration, is getting raked over the coals. And so I'm wondering, why is it this one? Why is this the road traveled too far? Why is this beyond the pale.
Well, we don't know what position the person holds. We don't know who the individual is. But, Matt, I'll let you respond to the New York Times being the place where the story was placed.
Well, again, it's not a question of whether you trust or don't trust the New York Times. I'm glad the caller trusts the New York Times. It's not a question of that. The bottom line is we know very, very little. This is sort of a cloak and dagger. Here is this anonymous senior staffer. This could be anybody. This could be a cabinet official. Is it a military person? Are they concerned about the military consequences? Or is this a domestic policy staffer who's concerned about Trump's approach to immigration or health care? We don't know any of these issues. We just know that this person is some anonymous person. And the bottom line is it's not a question. I'd have a problem with this if it was the Wall Street Journal, if this were the Washington Post. The problem is you're basically taking an institution, meaning the press, which is one particular press, which, by the way, has a self-interest in this, which is clicks, eyeballs, and everybody is self-interested, and is just saying, trust us, this is a senior enough person, and this is worthy of really pretty much breaking almost any editorial rule by putting in an anonymous op-ed in the paper just because we say so. So it's not a question if the caller trusts the New York Times, good for him. But that has nothing to do with whether one institution should make this kind of unilateral decision to anonymously publish this as if this is some big bombshell when we just don't know anything more than the words that are on the piece of paper.
Well, it's funny. I mean, just journalistically for us at KPCC, mm-hmm. I can't, in terms of our journalistic ethics, say it is a senior administration. I'd say purportedly or the New York Times claims because we have no independent verification of that as a news organization.
Right.
So speaks to that point. Let me share some more comments that are coming in. Let's say Robert writes on the page, why print this now? Trump is on the verge of putting the equivalent of his Bob Haldeman on the Supreme Court. Evidence coming out that his history is being a political hack and changing his opinions to suit the needs of his benefactors. What beautiful timing to move the spotlight. So it's a bit of the conspiratorial thing. Angela writes on the page, there's nothing normal about this presidency or this president. Why does this op-ed surprise anyone? Seriously, the rules for civility and societies and politics went out the window November 8th, 2016. Angela, I'd argue it was even before then, although things certainly appear to be getting worse. Seriously writes, this writer did a huge disservice to civil service employees and has proven there is some deep state-like behavior going on, which I think many took with a grain of salt before, but now has some legs with this writer's piece. I guess what rubs me the wrong way about it is it's not democratic behavior. Long-term public employees serve the people, not politics. I fear this will harm public workers. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Let me go back to Sean Walsh. Sean, you know, your thoughts about is there any benefit to non-Trump Republicans in what this writer has to say?
Well, I think there is in some respects, but let me take it out a step further. I mean, there's a belief by a lot of Republicans that even though they have difficulties with some of the things that President Trump tweets out, some of the things he says, his vulgarity and in the way he addresses issues, many of them do believe there is a war on A, the president, and B, Republicans from the media. And you look at the broad-based media. And you look at the types of negative stories about the Trump administration, and they're overwhelmingly negative against him and against Republicans. You look at the activist stuff with screaming people in the aisles and in the hearings for Mr. Kavanaugh and some of the other the social media issues this week. And I think this has political effect for a lot of Republicans who may have been doubtful about, you know, President Trump and backing people to dig their heels in and say, yeah, the media is against them. And yeah, I'm going to have an opposite reaction and be more motivated to come out to the polls. So I think there's political ramifications. And, you know, the New York Times can pat itself on the back and say, yes, we published this issue. But, you know, the truth of the matter is they could have decided not to publish this. This is not some national security issue where you're potentially exposing someone who is in the intelligence community and could be hurt or killed, like the recording from the New York Times op-ed page editor. This was about giving somebody a platform to speak, and if they felt this way, allowing them to do it anonymously and not do it on the record. And so I think that New York Times plays right into the narrative that a lot of Republicans feel that the media is just biased against them. And I think it's problematic from, and I love the media. I really do. I respect them. But I do think that.
Thank you, Sean.
A little bit.
All right. You brought up the confirmation hearings for Judge Brett Kavanaugh. The hearings are in their third day, and you've got all kinds of fireworks that occurred. Late last night, for example, California Junior Senator Kamala Harris, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, finally got her turn to question Judge Kavanaugh. And here was a highly fiery exchange about the Mueller investigation.
Judge, have you ever discussed Special Counsel Mueller or his investigation with anyone?
Well, it's in the news every day.
Have you discussed it with anyone?
With other judges, I know.
Have you discussed Mueller or his investigation with anyone at Cassowitz, Benson, and Torres, the law firm founded by Mark Cassowitz, President Trump's personal lawyer? Be sure about your answer, sir.
Well, I'm not remembering, but if you have something you want to...
Are you certain you've not had a conversation with anyone at that law firm? Cassowitz, Benson, and Torres, which is the law firm founded by Mark Cassowitz, who is President Trump's personal lawyer. Have you had any conversation about Robert Mueller or his investigation with anyone at that firm? Yes or no?
Well, is there a person you're talking about?
I'm asking you a very direct question. Yes or no?
I need to know the I'm not sure I know everyone who works at that law firm.
I don't think you need to. I think you need to know who you talked with. Who'd you talk to?
I don't think I'm not remembering, but I'm happy to be refreshed, or if you want to tell me who you're thinking
of. Are you saying that with all that you remember, you have an impeccable memory? You've been speaking for almost 8 hours, I think more, with this committee about all sorts of things you remember. Yeah. How can you not remember whether or not you had a conversation about Robert Mueller or his investigation with anyone at that law firm? This investigation has only been going on for so long, sir. So
right, I'm not sure I'm just trying to think, do I know anyone who works at that firm? I might know.
That's not my question. My question is, have you had a conversation with anyone at that firm about that investigation? It's a really specific question.
I would like to know the person you're thinking of, because what if there's...
I think you're thinking of someone and you don't want to tell us. Who did you have a conversation with at that
firm? I'm not going
to... Mr. Chairman, I'd like to raise an objection here. This town is full of law firms. Law firms are full of people.
First of all, I'd like you to pause the clock. Thank you.
The clock is paused.
Thank you.
Pause the clock. Let me raise my objection.
Recognized.
This town is full of law firms. Law firms are full of people. Law firms have a lot of names. There are a lot of people who work at a lot of law firms.
Even though the hour was late, energy still high. You heard Kamala Harris, California's senator, hearkening back to her days as a prosecutor with Judge Kavanaugh on the stand. That was Utah Republican Mike Lee raising the objection. And, of course, that was one of many protesters who've risen from the crowd during the course of these 3 days to voice their protest against the confirmation of Kavanaugh. Joining us from the Wall Street Journal, legal affairs reporter Brent Kennedy. Brent, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what have we heard today, particularly coming out of the table that was set by Kamala Harris?
Well, so, you know, there was a lot more political heat when we started this morning, you know, that had little to do with Judge Kavanaugh. And he sat there and watched while the Republicans and Democrats went back and forth at one another. I mean, the Republicans were highly critical of how Senator Harris sort of approached her questioning last night, as you said, in kind of a prosecutorial manner, and suggested that that wasn't a, you know, a proper way to conduct questioning for these hearings. You know, Mike Lee, who from Utah, who was you know, in that exchange that you played, you know, addressed this more today, and when he questioned Judge Kavanaugh, followed up on this idea about whether the judge had talked to anybody at this law firm or, you know, made any promises related to the Mueller investigation or anything of that nature, and the judge said he had not, and that didn't even know who'd worked at the law firm, and that he'd come to find out that former Senator Lieberman did, and he recognized a couple of other names at the firm, but by and large didn't know anybody over there. Aside from that, I mean, a lot of the mourning has been, continued and in some ways escalated battles over documents from Judge Kavanaugh's time in the White House and what has and hasn't been released. And then there were documents that had been classified as what's called committee confidential, meaning that members of the Senate Judiciary Committee could see them, but the public could not. And some Democrats today said, we're not going to abide by that, and we're going to release them to the public anyway.
And so Cory Booker released one that had to do, I believe, with there was a line of racial profiling, and then a tranche of those committee restricted documents were released by the chair, right?
That's right. I mean, it's not entirely clear at this point the sequence of events. I mean, Senator Booker said, I think the public needs to see these documents. I want to be able to reference them when I'm questioning the nominee. And, I'm not going to abide by these rules, even if it means, serious penalties for me, such as expulsion from the Senate. And he took some heat from Senator John Cornyn from Texas, who said that was an irresponsible thing to do. I mean, the committee has cleared the release of some of these documents. Senator Booker released them about the time when he was speaking this morning. It's not entirely clear whether the committee had already cleared them for release at that point. I mean, either way, they are now out in the public, both released by Senator Booker and by the committee. And some of the emails have to do with discussions that Judge Kavanaugh had been involved in the White House involving issues of, racial preferences, and suggest, as people sort of thought anyway, that he's not a huge fan of racial preference type programs.
So it's not necessarily revelatory, just confirmation of assumptions about his conservative worldview.
I think that's fair. I mean, the one thing to keep in mind here, we have had this huge fight about documents, and the Democrats say, well, it's hard for us to know what's in there and what they may tell us about this nominee, which is certainly true. But he's also been on the bench for more than a decade and, has written more than 300 opinions. So from reading those opinions, people have reached conclusions about, where he's coming from and his legal thinking. And so, I mean, I think by and large, the documents that we have seen would sort of be of a piece of what most people would have already thought about, how he approached these issues.
Brent, I appreciate it. Thank you for updating us on what's gone on over the past 12 hours with these hearings. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Wall Street Journal legal affairs reporter Brent Kendall joining us. Coming up, we'll hear from our political analysts. They're still with us, Sean Walsh and Matt Rodriguez. And we'll also bring two legal scholars in to talk about the issues that have been unfolding over these first nearly three full days of the Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearings for Judge Brett Kavanaugh. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdy's. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, and I underreported. We have three great legal scholars with us, not just two. We're going to bring in multiple points of view about the confirmation hearings, day three of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. I begin with Loyola Law Professor based here in Los Angeles, Kim West Falcone. Thank you so much, Professor, for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So your sense, first of all, of just overall how this has unfolded over the past 3 days. Have you learned anything about Judge Kavanaugh?
I think I have learned a couple of things. They are not novel to Judge Kavanaugh, but I think what we've seen over the last several days is that he has mastered what has been true of the last several decades, the skill of answering questions in this context without being particularly forthcoming. And so we haven't gotten a lot of insights into the kind of substance that, again, many decades ago, was part and parcel of this kind of hearing.
So in the past, pre-Bork, would you have nominated judges who would actually talk about their political ideology and how that might influence their legal decisions?
Well, I think we definitely up to and including Judge Bork, had an opportunity through Senate confirmation hearings, and the senators themselves had an opportunity to get some substantive answers regarding judicial philosophy, approaches to constitutional interpretation, with a degree of specificity that permitted not just Judge Bork, but other nominees in, to be vetted in a substantive way. And I think that vetting was sometimes about the specifics of their approaches to constitutional interpretation, which I think was key with Judge Bork in the late 1980s. But in some instances, you had nominees who weren't successful because of things that revealed about their personal lives. I mean, in a modern context, the fact that someone used marijuana would maybe not be disqualifying in 2018. But there was an opportunity and a presumption that everything in both your personal and professional life was fair game, and fair game to be interrogated with specificity, and that there was an obligation to actually provide a substantive answer.
There have been chaotic periods during the course of this confirmation process, arguably one of, if not the most contentious in modern history. And this is essentially about taking a swing, you know, sort of center-right justice's seat and replacing it with someone who I think is universally perceived as on the right, not a swing vote. What happens when you've actually got the potential for a clearly defined conservative or clearly defined progressive judge to flip to the opposite side? Is that going to be even more rancorous?
I think that every seat will have high stakes going forward. And I think, in addition to what you're pointing out about the presumed political leanings and judicial philosophy of the nominee, what we've seen with respect to how Senate confirmation hearings at the Supreme Court level have been administered, I think, has created angst and concern, not just on the committee, but throughout society as a whole. Had Judge Merrick Garland had a confirmation hearing, we might be in a different moment now, that the stakes have been raised because of the political way in which the Senate has handled its advise and consent power. That would be my opinion, that the stakes are raised because there's a concern that the process itself is being handled in a politically motivated and driven manner, and that a lot of what we're seeing with respect to Judge Kavanaugh's hearing is, I think, concern that the process is not being given sufficient time because there's a political motivation to beat the clock of the midterm elections. So I think that's what's driving a lot of the objections about process, we need more time.
Yeah, but as you know, the timing in this is consistent with the timing that there's been on previous confirmation processes. So it's not being rushed compared to those.
Since that timing has historically been dictated by what kind of record the candidate has. And so when you nominate a candidate like Judge Kavanaugh, who has such an extensive history in various professional realms, but all public, it's different from nominating a candidate who was in private practice, that means that it's more documents, it takes longer to review them. And so it used to be, or it would have normally been part of the course, to have that be part of the strategy, that if you really want a nomination hearing to take place before the midterms, then you don't choose to appoint someone like Judge Kavanaugh, who would require such a long time to vet. Instead, what we have here is we're going to appoint someone who historically would take a long time to vet because the documents would be numerous and we would go through the National Archives, and then to decide we're going to circumvent that. And I think that's leading to what you're describing as rancor, and some would describe as, you know, civil disobedience about a process with which they disagree.
We're talking with Loyola Law Professor Kim West Falcone. Also with us, Richard Garnett. He's Professor of Law and Concurrent Professor of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame. Professor Garnett, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'd like you to just follow along with Professor West Falcone. Your response to the timing of all this, and do you think it plays into this rancor?
Well, I agree entirely with my colleague in terms she led off talking about the stakes, and there certainly is a perception that the stakes of this nomination are high. And one reason for that, in addition to the controversies with respect to Judge Garland, is simply that the Supreme Court, over the last several decades, has come to occupy such a central place in American life and in how Americans think about government and rights and the powers of the state and so on. It really shouldn't be any surprise that when the Supreme Court comes to occupy a central role, that people are going to care a whole lot about who's on the Supreme Court. Justice Scalia used to complain about this in his speeches. He would say the reason why the confirmation process is so rancorous and partisan is because Americans quite reasonably see that very important decisions about things that people care about a lot are being made by the court. And perhaps one lesson there is that if the court occupied a smaller space in our public life, we could get back to regular order in confirmation hearings. The second point having to do with the timing, I guess with all due respect, I don't see this as a case where the process is being circumvented or rushed, as you pointed out. This is consistent with past practice, and it's never been the case that a nominee has had all of his or her documents from all of his or her work presented to the committee. It's always been the case that there's had to have been some culling and so on, and sometimes it's been because of privilege, and sometimes it's been because of relevance. And so I don't see this as being all that different. What I see is that there's a certain kind of work that Judge Kavanaugh did when he was staff secretary, where a lot of paper would cross his desk even though it wasn't his work product. And I think what's unusual here is the Democrats have been pressing to get a whole lot of that material when it's not clear that that's really relevant to Judge Kavanaugh's own views or his own qualifications for this position. So we know a lot about Judge Kavanaugh. He's been a distinguished judge for a decade on a very important court. And in terms of a judicial record, we have more to go on with respect to him than we've had to go on with respect to many nominees. If anything, the senator should be pleased that he's the nominee because he's shown them in great detail how he acts as a judge.
We'll continue. Richard Garnett joining us from University of Notre Dame, Kim West Falcone of Loyola Law School, and we'll talk with George Mason University professor Ilya Soman coming up. We're taking a look at the Kavanaugh confirmation hearing 3 days in. It's Air Talk on KPCC. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We're talking about the 3 days of confirmation hearings for Judge Brett Kavanaugh to be the next Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. With us is Professor George Mason University School of Law, Ilya Soman. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Thank you for having me.
So what stands out to you over the past 12 hours or so of these hearings?
There's been a lot that's occurred. Obviously, the procedural fighting that was already mentioned. I think also this hearing is unusual for focusing on executive power issues far more than any other confirmation hearing, at least that I can remember. And I think that's partly because of Judge Kavanaugh's very extensive record on executive power, which includes, I think, some very positive things, but also some more problematic ones. But obviously, it's there partly because of Trump and the way that he overshadows this hearing and the issues surrounding the Mueller investigation and other problems that Trump has had.
Do you feel like you have a better understanding of the judge's view of executive power?
Probably only slightly better because he has written a good deal about executive power in the past, so it's not like his views were a mystery beforehand. But he did say a few things that I thought were notable. One is he reaffirmed and emphasized that he thought that the Nixon tapes case was one of the great moments in the history of the Supreme Court, which suggests, though he didn't quite say it, that he agrees with the decision. Another is that he stated something that I thought was not covered much in the media, but was pretty telling, where he said that Congress has broad power to regulate the president's use of war powers, and that the president has only a narrow ability to just ignore what Congress does. And he specifically mentioned prisoner policies and interrogation, meaning issues like torture, as an area that Congress does have the power to regulate. That's very different from, say, the notorious John U. torture memo, where you basically said that the president has the power to disregard Congress in this respect. And I think those comments, while certainly not entirely surprising, were at least somewhat reassuring. On some other important executive power issues, he hemmed and hawed somewhat, and therefore we don't actually know much more than we did from his previous writings. So those writings are themselves extensive.
On the first day, the second day, because it was when he was asked questions, he was asked about whether he thought a president could pardon himself. And he didn't answer that question, but is there anything in the judge's writings that would give a clue on that?
Not to my knowledge. He has written about a lot of other executive power issues, but the question about whether a president can pardon himself is one that has never been decided by a court, to my knowledge. It's never even come up, that issue. And it's one that legal scholars disagree on. So it's simply hard to say where Kavanaugh stands on that. It would be nice to know, on the other hand, in refusing to answer, Kavanaugh was following this sort of emergent norm of nominees refusing to talk about future cases that could come before them.
All right. Let me bring back in Sean Walsh, Republican political strategist. Sean, quickly, your response to Kamala Harris last night and her pushing of Judge Kavanaugh on whether he'd spoken of the Mueller investigation to an attorney at a D.C. firm.
I think it was ridiculous, and it was part of the political theater. Look, she's running for president. She's trying to put herself up as kind of this new Democrat in the activist mold. If you have somebody, just put their name out, ask the question, and be done with it. You know, it's like I've got a list of 52 communists in my pocket, and she pulls it out and waves it in front of the committee. I just thought it was silly.
Sean, your take on whether she helped herself, or I'm sorry, Matt, your take on whether she helped herself.
Look, everyone, look, this is politics, right? And so everyone has multiple audiences they're looking at. And, you know, she has been very successful in her first couple of years here, sort of playing to the base and trying to create moments through committee questions. Well, I couldn't quite get where she was going with it, because if she had a name, he sort of kept asking, I'm not really sure. So I wasn't sure if there's something more to this. And I think Kavanaugh came out this morning and said, I've not had a discussion about Mueller with anyone else or with anybody at that firm, Kasowitz firm. So I'm not really sure where she was going with it. It seemed to be like a big lead up, and it seems to have fizzled a bit. Did it help or hurt? I mean, look, the bottom line is these senators, you kind of see a lot of the old versus new here. Sort of you see Feinstein and Grassley, some of these sort of older guard, trying to be somewhat respectful but serious in terms of asking questions that are more illegal in nature. And then you have the Bookers and the Harris types, both
who are running for president, yeah,
really looking for their meme moment, their Twitter moment, and they're doing a lot of gotcha stuff. And I was getting the Kevin DeLeon emails during the hearing as Feinstein's asking questions. This is ridiculous. She needs to resist and do all this stuff. And so
that was amazing. Yeah. His campaign got out a release criticizing her for how she did the question.
Yeah.
I think it was before she was even done.
Before she was finished. Yeah. So welcome to politics, right? You're in a political season and we have elections coming up. So you not only have Republicans versus Democrats, but Democrats versus Democrats. And so there's a lot going on here. I thought the Kamala question was sort of odd, but she's looking to a different audience than what is sitting in that committee room.
All right. I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist. He's based here in Los Angeles with his firm, Rodriguez Strategies, former senior Obama advisor. Also with us, Sean T. Walsh of Wilson Walsh Consulting, San Francisco, former advisor to Governors Pete Wilson and Arnold Schwarzenegger, and former staffer in the Reagan and H.W. Bush White Houses. And my thanks to our three legal scholar who joins us, Ilya Soman of George Mason University, Richard Garnett of Notre Dame, and Kim West Falcone of Loyola Law School. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. There'll be much more coverage of the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings coming up this afternoon at 4 on All Things Considered here on 89.3 KPCC. Much more to come in our second hour, including a big Justice Department announcement. We'll tell you in a moment.
KPCC podcasts are supported by SoCalGas, helping businesses improve their bottom line with solar water heating. The system preheats your water using the strength of the sun. It works with your existing natural gas water heater to warm your water in a reliable and efficient way. You may save on your SoCal gas bill and get rebates that may cover up to 80% of the system's cost. With these rebates, heating water with the sun could be a sound investment. It's the strength of the sun in your business. Learn more at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, the NFL regular season kicks off tonight. The Rams are going to play their first game starting Monday night in a nationally televised Monday night football game. Chargers starting play this weekend as well. Much to talk about with the future of professional football here in L.A. and nationally. A. Martinez is going to be joining us to talk about it, as well as Gary Klein, who writes about pro football for the Los Angeles Times. He's the Rams beat reporter. But first, the Justice Department has announced criminal charges in connection with the hack of Sony Pictures Entertainment back in 2014. Authorities are charging a North Korean who's believed to have operated out of China. The U.S. government had previously said North Korea was responsible for the cyber attack, which resulted in disclosure of tens of thousands of leaked emails and other materials. This relating to the release of the film The Interview, a comedy starring Seth Rogen and James Franco. It's centered on a plot to assassinate North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Sony canceled the theatrical release of the film after moviegoers were threatened. It was released through YouTube and other online sites instead. With us to talk about the charges is Aruna Viswanatha, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal who covers the Justice Department. Aruna, thank you for being with us.
Good to be with you.
So share with us who this individual is, and is this person in custody?
This individual, I'm not even sure how to pronounce his name correctly, but Mr. Park Hyuk, is a 34, a North Korean citizen. He's not in custody. He's believed to be in North Korea. He did live in China for some time, returned to North Korea before many of the activities that are at issue in the complaint. He's not in custody. He's not expected to be in custody anytime soon. There was no discussion between the U.S. government and the North Korean government about this case before it was released today.
The allegations include not only the intrusion into Sony's computers, but also the development of the malware known as WannaCry, the ransomware attack back in 2017. Theft of $81 million from a bank in Bangladesh, and a variety of other attacks on entertainment companies, financial institutions. These charges are pretty wide-ranging, and share with us what the government is alleging about the motive behind these attacks.
That's right. They are painting this very wide-ranging conspiracy to go after multiple targets for multiple reasons. They are not explaining a lot about the motivations, but it seems pretty clear that this is a regime that needs money and was going after financial institutions, going after the Bangladesh bank's account at the Federal Reserve in order to get millions of dollars, and then was also targeting things like Sony Pictures when they were releasing a movie that was not favorable to the North Korean government. And so the motives seem to be very aligned with what the North Korean government is interested in, but they are not. The case does not explicitly lay out the motivation.
Aruna, I know you're on deadline. Thanks so much for spending these minutes with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for having me.
From the Wall Street Journal, Justice Department reporter Aruna Viswanatha. Also with us from the New York Times, national security correspondent David Sanger. David, good to have you with us again.
Good to be with you.
So what is this work for hire that's alleged? In other words, North Korean government alleged hires Mr. Park to carry out these intrusions, or is he working for multiple different clients, or this coming at his own initiative?
Well, I think the context in which you have to understand this is that this was not
by any means a standalone attack. And the North Koreans, while they may hire outside hackers, don't deal with freelancers. This was run out of the Reconnaissance General Bureau, which is the sort of North Korean equivalent of the CIA. And I wrote about this at length in The Perfect Weapon, a book that came out a little more than two months ago, about sort of the degree of cyber conflict we have underway. And the story of the United States and North Korea is one of a low-level, two-way cyber conflict that's been going on for many years. Obviously, the United States went after North Korea's missile control systems for their missile tests. The North Koreans came after Sony, and as the legal complaint that was submitted by the Justice Department today goes through, now familiar to those who have been following all of this, the North Koreans also stole $81 million out of the Bangladeshi bank. It's described in the complaint. They were trying to get a billion, but they made a spelling mistake on the way to doing the transfer orders. They've attacked the African bank. They've attacked South American currency exchanges. And, of course, they did WannaCry. What the complaint omits is that the WannaCry code, the software code that went in and it ended up doing so much damage to the British healthcare system, was actually code that got lost by the National Security Agency, our premier cyber operation. And so they shot American-written code back at an American ally. That the complaint says nothing about that.
Wow. So this is all done at the behest of the North Korean government. So I'm presuming he's being protected in North Korea. There'd be no way to extradite him.
Yeah, although some of the activity, as we've documented in stories we've written in the Times since this first happened in 2014, and as the complaint noticed, the hackers sometimes work out of North Korea, but sometimes work out of China and other countries. We've seen cases, they're not described in this complaint, where the hackers appear to have been operating out of Thailand, Malaysia, elsewhere in Asia. And that, in part, is to hide their North Korean roots.
Is there any way that the United States would get cooperation from those other countries to expedite this individual or others who are engaging in the same practices?
Well, we don't know where this individual is. We assume he's in North Korea. The Chinese would be unlikely to extradite him. The Thais or Malaysians might. You know, this is a lot like those indictments that the Justice Department did of Iranian hackers for their activity against American financial institutions, against Chinese hackers for Unit 61398, the People's Liberation Army unit that hacked into so many American companies. You don't do these indictments with an expectation that these people will see the inside of an American courtroom, but it does bottle them up in their own country. They're not exactly going to take the kids to Disneyland they're under indictment in the United States.
The indictment, at least the release that I've read, indicates that this Lazarus Group, of which Mr. Park is alleged to be a member, that they have worked for other clients. So who are some of the other potential clients beyond the North Korean government itself?
Well, the complaint does not indicate who, but usually what you'll discover with hackers is that they are out there for hire. Their primary allegiance is usually to their own country, and in the case of North Korea, you don't really have a choice. But we've seen in Russian cases that they used outside hackers who at various times may have worked for other countries. You see that for others, in part because they have to be trained for these other countries. So there's a reason North Korean hackers go to China. There's a much bigger computer technology and hacking community in China, obviously, than there is in a country that's got, you know, a little over 1,000 IP addresses, which is what North Korea has.
We're talking with the New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger. He's author of The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. We're talking about the Justice Department's announcement today of criminal charges against a North Korean national alleged to have carried out not just the hack of Sony Entertainment Studios here in Los Angeles, but also WannaCry 2.0, that malware, which had a big effect across the web, also other major operations for financial gain or to further the political interests of the North Korean government. With the announcement of these charges, David, what sort of political, geopolitical impact, if any, do you think it has?
Well, a couple of interesting things. So just a few hours before this indictment was announced and the Treasury Department announced new sanctions, President Trump issued a new tweet sort of welcoming comments that Kim Jong-un made and saying, we'll work together to solve this, meaning the North Korean nuclear program. Unclear to us whether he knew that Kim Jong-un's cyber deputies were about to go get indicted hours later. But it does fit to this disconnect in which the president says kind things about a foreign leader, and then we turn around and sanction the country. Same things happen, of course, with Russia, given the U.S. sanctions and indictments against Russian hackers just in the past few months. So the second geopolitical issue is this. Our current negotiations with North Korea, to the degree that they're still going on, and they're not going on very well, are about the nuclear program. But what the North Koreans have attacked us with in the past few years has all been cyber, because you can use cyber without fear of retaliation, the way obviously you couldn't with a nuclear weapon. And right now, there is no discussion that we're hearing within the United States government about having a serious conversation with North Korea about the cyber attacks the North is launching on us or about the ones the United States has launched on North Korea.
And is there evidence that those North Korean attacks are continuing or going on right now?
You know, the way attacks work is that they require a lot of time and patience. One of the things that comes through in the criminal complaint is that the attackers against Sony were in for months before that happened. In the Bangladeshi bank case, they were in for years before that happened. So when do you say an attack has begun? When they've actively gone into battle mode or when they've placed the implants into a foreign system? And yes, there are North Korean implants in American systems. Do we know where all of them are? Certainly not. And one of the most fascinating things about Sony, as I describe in the book, is that the American radar was off to this. There was nothing in the American intelligence system that would tell you that a foreign power is into an American company's computer networks, partly because the foreign intelligence agencies, the NSA, the CIA, and others, aren't allowed to operate in the United States. And it wasn't clear that the Sony was even going to be a target. Of course, they were for, as you described in your earlier conversation, for this movie, The Interview, which envisioned the assassination of Kim Jong-un. It was a comedy. Of course, the North Koreans took this as a deep insult against the state and their leader.
We're talking with David Sanger, New York Times national security correspondent, also alleged in the indictment back in February of 2016, mentioned the Bangladesh bank heist, $81 million. But it's around the same time, 2016-2017, the conspiracy is alleged to have targeted U.S. defense contractors, including Lockheed Martin, with spear phishing emails. Is it known if any classified information about weapon systems or the like were obtained as a part of that spear phishing effort?
It's not alleged that they actually got very much. Now, Lockheed Martin is a big target and a frequent target. It was a frequent target of the Chinese. The Chinese, of course, got the designs for the F-35, the American next generation stealth fighter. Lockheed, you know, is basically the target of all major state actors. But in this particular case, we don't know, or at least I'm not aware, of any successful North Korean hacks against Lockheed.
Ultimately, what do you think, David, is going to be the effect of this? Is there any impact on efforts of North Korea or other countries to engage in cyber intrusion?
Well, look, it's a good thing if the United States government gets out and publicly names the offenders and puts some criminal charges out in the ground. And the Trump administration, I think, has done a good job, probably a little more aggressively than the Obama administration did, in getting out and at least naming and shaming countries. After WannaCry, it took a few months, but the Trump administration came out and said this was North Korea. After the big attacks on Ukraine last year, the Trump administration came out and said this was Russia that took place in it. In the Sony case, that was the one exception where President Obama actually came to the press room of the White House in December of 2014 and announced that North Korea was the culprit. It was actually only in the cases of Russia and China where the Obama administration was a lot more shy about naming them at the time. The big question is, does this strategy of indictment actually create much deterrent effect? Or since the indictments are unlikely to result in criminal trials of the individuals, do the countries just sort of shrug it off as a cost of doing business and keep using the weapon that they've used so successfully before?
David, great to talk with you again. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
Author of The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. He writes on national security for the New York Times, correspondent David Sanger. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up later this hour, we're going to talk with a man at the center of development of autonomous vehicles. He's a GM for many years and then consulted with Google on their autonomous vehicles. He's written a book about his experience and the future of self-driving cars. That to come a little bit later this hour. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. While the NFL's regular season kicks off tonight, nationally televised game between the Eagles and the Falcons, the Birds play in Philadelphia tonight, an NBC televised game. And then, of course, the rest of the teams get into action over the course of the weekend. We're going to preview the seasons for our local teams, the Rams and the Chargers, and also talk about some of the biggest issues facing the NFL overall. Joining me, the host of Take Two, A. Martinez, devoted Chargers fan, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that, I've always liked them, that lightning bolt. You know me.
It is a cool logo. Yeah. And the flash.
The flash on the desk,
And the gentleman who covers the Rams as their beat reporter for the Los Angeles Times, Gary Klein. Gary, great to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me. Good to be in esteemed company.
All right. Let's start first with the league and sort of, you know, what it's dealing with right now. A, the league is still dealing with the politics of the taking a knee, polarizing effect on audiences, concerned of oversaturation of NFL games on TV, Thursday night games that have been crummy matchups. You know, even though there's still event viewing, high ratings overall, they have declined. What do you think the future of the league is?
Well, they've talked about a lot of different things. Number one, not having as many preseason games, but then getting some regular season games on the back end to cover it. I think they've got a little bit of an issue of oversaturation. For me, someone that plays fantasy football, I'll take as many games as I can get. And for people that gamble on the sport, they'll take as many games as they can
get.
You'll
even watch those dreadful Thursday night matchups.
Every single minute of those things. But for the casual fan that just wants to watch some NFL football once in a while, it does seem like a lot. And then, as you mentioned, you get these bad matchups. I think the only way it's going to be resolved is through collective bargaining, because the players, I'm sure, are going to want something in return for anything possible that they give up.
Well, and Gary, the Rams, a prime example, here's a team expected to be a prime Super Bowl contender, and their starting quarterback, Jared Goff, the starting running back, Todd Gurley, their greatest defensive player, Aaron Donald, none of them play a single minute in the preseason. What's up with that?
Well, it's definitely an unorthodox approach to this season, but I think it speaks to what A was addressing in terms of the league has really changed. This isn't the 70s or the 80s where teams go out and play all their players in the preseason. Now, these are such highly paid investments that coaches are a little apprehensive about putting them at risk. The risk reward of getting some preseason snaps versus keeping them out of harm's way and having them available for when it really counts. I think this is an extreme example with the Rams, and part of it was circumstance, just the way that the NFL scheduled a preseason game between the Rams and the Raiders just a few weeks before they were going to meet in Monday night's in their Monday night's football opener. But I just think it speaks to, again, the collective bargaining agreement. The players do not want to play four preseason games. Those are on sale, so owners can force fans to buy two extra games. And I think we'll see if that get resolved in the collective bargaining agreement with more regular season games.
Yeah, just what a waste of time, it seems, those preseason games. It just we have breaking news to share with you on a totally separate issue. The Motion Picture Academy just announced it will not present that new Oscar category for the upcoming awards. They had talked about creating a category for popular film, and instead the Academy just announcing that the idea merits further study, that it is still actively engaged in discussions, will examine and seek additional input regarding the popular film category. The quote from Academy CEO Don Hudson: "There's been a wide range of reactions to the introduction of a new award, and we recognize the need for further discussion with our members. We have made changes to the Oscars over the years, including this year, and we will continue to evolve while also respecting the incredible legacy of the last 90 years. So again, the Academy, I think not really a huge surprise given the backlash against the announcement that they would create a popular film category, which wasn't explained what that would encompass. The Academy now backing away from the creation of that new category, at least temporarily. Your thoughts on preseason? Obviously, coaches love it because they get a chance to look at the rookies and players who are on the bubble and see how they perform and get a sense of the backups. But for the fans, it's a bummer.
Oh, they're useless. They're useless games. And Sam mentioned, a fan that wants to buy season tickets to the Rams also has to buy some preseason games too. And I don't know if fans need the practice, Larry, to go out to spend money at the stadium.
They don't feel they do, looking at the number of empty seats.
Right, pay for hundreds of dollars worth of parking and all that. They are useless in so many different ways, but I guess they are needed in just to kind of get people back in the flow of things. But I can't see how the NFL Players Union will allow for anything less than getting something in return, whether it's guaranteed money on contracts, other safety measures, something in return for kind of mixing the deck up a little bit and how they spread out the games that they play. Because you're right, they have a limited amount of contact that these players can take over their lifetime. They just can't waste it in games that mean nothing.
Let's talk about the Rams, Gary, a team full of stars. They even imported big names as free agents. You've got the youngest coach in the league who in 1 year has established himself as a star as well. The expectations are huge for the Rams, and that can be a challenge for teams living up to it. Your thoughts on the team's prospects?
We'll see if Sean McVay was a one-hit wonder or not. I don't think that's the case, but the Rams certainly have taken, well, they're attempting to take advantage, Larry, of a window, because they have Jared Goff, the quarterback you mentioned, as a rookie contract. He's not making $25, $30 million a year. He's in the $7 million range. And that's allowed the Rams to go out and go shopping and get star players like Marcus Peters and Aqib Talib and Ndamukong Suh and Brandon Cooks. So the Rams have kind of pushed their chips into the center of the table, not only for this season, but also for years to come, because they have this window with where Goff isn't making the kind of money that Aaron Rodgers is making with the Green Bay Packers or Matt Ryan's making with the Atlanta Falcons. This is their opportunity to do that. I think owner Stan Kroenke realizes in the L.A. market, you need star power. They're opening that new stadium in 2 years, and they want to sell season tickets to that now. So all of that figures into what's happening with the Rams. And now, as you mentioned, big expectations for a team that really didn't have many last year, and they're going to have to learn to deal with it going into this season.
Every team is going to be up for them. They do get Aaron Donald under contract. Is it still the biggest contract for a defensive player in the league?
Larry, that lasted one day.
I thought there might have been, after that big trade out of Oakland, change in that.
Exactly. The Oakland Raiders decided to trade Khalil Mack to the Chicago Bears, and he topped it the next day. The Rams gave Aaron Donald $135 million. Khalil Mack got 141 from the Bears. But just also playing to that the theme we were talking about, the Rams pushing all their chips in, they were attempting to trade for Khalil Mack.
Oh, my goodness.
Last minute. And the Raiders said, your first-round pick is going to be too low, and they kind of dropped out of those that suite.
Could you imagine if the Rams got Mack on top of Donald and all the other talent on that team?
They wouldn't allow any points, ever.
That's right. It's just talk about a wall. They would be one on the field. Your Chargers, also talented team. What are your expectations for them?
Yeah, they had a good ending to this season last season. They lost. They won six of their last seven games. It looked like they were going to make a last-second push to the playoffs. It fell short. You got to remember, they lost their first four games last season, and two of those games were on missed or botched field goal attempts. They had brought in a brand-new kicker. Maybe he wasn't quite ready for prime time, and they got off to a bad start. But the division, the AFC West, which includes Kansas City and the Oakland Raiders, isn't as strong now, as you just mentioned, with Khalil Mack leaving the division for another team for the Chicago Bears. They actually have a chance, a little tiny window right now, to actually make some moves and make a good play for the playoffs. I have a dream, Larry Mantle, and you know this dream, that one day the Rams and the Chargers will meet in an all-Los Angeles Super Bowl. Ideally, the year that both are playing in their home stadium in the Super Bowl, which is in Inglewood in a couple of years. That would be the best scenario, but they could actually make it happen today because legitimately both teams are playoff teams, and legitimately once the playoffs start, you never know what could happen. Can you imagine Rams Chargers Super Bowl?
I love it. I just took a photo of you. A is sitting there with his little helmets of the Rams and the Chargers.
I still play with
facing
them.
Off. I know, cute little helmets. All right, we'll see. Would be great to have our local teams in the Super Bowl. And as A
never
said,
happened.
Could you imagine in the new Inglewood Stadium, maybe the inaugural year?
That would be
very exciting. Gary, the challenge, of course, for the Chargers is attracting fans. They're playing temporarily in that intimate StubHub Center in Carson, but they have a big PR disadvantage being the second team back into the market.
I think they really do, and as A noted, I think the Chargers starting slowly last season, that 0-4 start, really kind of dampened any enthusiasm that might have built initially. They obviously finished strong. They have some great players on that team, some stars in Phillip Rivers. But I really think they're going to have an uphill battle, you know, just for the closest example that we can see in Los Angeles, it's like the Clippers and the Lakers. I think that unless the Chargers can kind of get going and almost establish themselves like the New England Patriots, where it's a year after year kind of thing, I think that they're going to have a hard time dealing with the glitz, dealing with the fact that they are a tenant for the Rams in that new stadium, you know, no matter how you slice it. And so I think the Chargers have an uphill battle. They do have some talent to maybe get over that, and they have a fan base with A being part of them.
He's good to have on your side. That's certainly true. Hey, Gary, real quickly, the challenge the league faced, I mean, there are multiple ones, head injuries, of course, and politics and glut of games. Do you think the league is going to be able to effectively deal with these multiple challenges?
I think it will deal with them. I think, though, they have been clumsy in many of their steps to this point. I don't know that there's any expectation that they're not going to be clumsy in handling these situations as they go on. But getting back to kind of the start of this conversation, I think the NFL is still a strong product. That fantasy football, the fact that gambling is going to become legalized, you know, throughout the country, or at least it looks that way, is going to keep interest high. So I think there's still an appetite for NFL football, but they're going to have to definitely work their way through those challenges.
All right. You agree, eh?
Oh, yeah. Football, it's not as popular maybe with parents as it once was, because who wants their kid to play football for their whole life? But the sport itself, as long as gambling and fantasy is a part of it, it will stay strong. It'll stay at number one above all the other major sports.
All right. And it is made for television.
Oh,
no
yeah.
question.
Yeah.
A. Martinez, host of Take Two. Gary Klein covers the Rams for the Los Angeles Times. Gentlemen, great to have you with us. Appreciate it so much. Again, the NFL regular season kicks off tonight in Philadelphia. And and the Chargers play this weekend. Rams are going to play the Raiders on Monday night. Coming up, we're going to talk with the man who's been at the center of the creation of autonomous and semi-autonomous vehicles. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Erdes. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. So good to have you with us. Joined by Lawrence Burns, who was Corporate VP of Research, Development, and Planning at General Motors. He oversaw GM's Advanced Technology and Innovation Programs. He's a professor of engineering practice at the University of Michigan. And he has been an advisor to Google's self-driving car project, now dubbed Waymo, since 2018. His new book is Autonomy, The Quest to Build the Driverless Car and How It Will Reshape Our World. Lawrence Burns, good to have you with us on Air Talk.
Yeah, thanks for having me today.
Let's start, first of all, with the various experiments in self-driving vehicles that were going on. We had the tragic incident in Tempe, Arizona, where the person crossing the street was hit and killed by a car where the backup driver apparently was not watching. Has that put a damper on the actual street usage of autonomous vehicles?
Actually, it hasn't put a damper for those who are following the best practices for developing self-driving cars for use on public roads. You mentioned I'm an advisor to Waymo. I've actually been doing that since 2011. And Waymo has accumulated, previously Google self-driving cars and now Waymo, they've accumulated 9 million miles of learning on public roads. They've had one at-fault accident, which was a 2-mile-per-hour collision with a bus and scratched the paint. If companies are following good practices and doing the development work can be done with a great deal of safety. And these two incidences, the one you mentioned in Arizona, as well as a Josh Brown fatality with a Tesla autopilot, in both cases, at least the investigations would suggest that those best practices weren't being followed.
Now, is the Phoenix project for the commercial ride-sharing service, is that ready to go this year?
Well, John Krafchuk, who's the CEO of Waymo, is indicating the intent for Waymo to launch that this year. And they're certainly working hard to deliver on that commitment on John's part.
And how would that work? People would sign up just like they would for any other ride-sharing service? This would just be a fully autonomous one?
Well, yes, that's how that would operate. They've had a group of what they call early adopters or early rider program in the Phoenix area, and a fleet of hundreds of vehicles. They're Chrysler Pacifica minivans equipped with Waymo self-driving technology. So you're right. You would hit an app and request a ride. The vehicle would pick you up at your location and take you to the location that you want to go to. And then after you're dropped off, it would be ready to go serve someone else in the area.
There have long been concerns about mixing between autonomous vehicles and human-driven vehicles, and that maybe they wouldn't be able to coexist, particularly once you hit a certain threshold on fully autonomous vehicles. Do you think that will be a challenge?
No, I actually don't. I believe Google self-driving cars made a very important decision early on that they could develop a robotic vehicle that could operate on its own mixed with human-driven cars. 90% of the crashes, actually more than 90% of the crashes that occur today are due to human error. And unfortunately, that leads to 40,000 fatalities in the U.S. and 1.3 million worldwide. So each autonomous vehicle that's on the road is not only going to make the occupants of that vehicle much, much safer, but they're going to make you safer because they're less likely to run into you. So I think they're going to be able to coexist. And that's one of the advantages of being able to launch this new technology without everybody having to have it before you get going.
One of the advantages of being a human driver is that you can potentially see signs of a problem before it's right in front of you. If you've driven a number of years, you can pick up on cues of something that might lead you to believe the driver of a certain vehicle is going to pose a danger once that car is closer to you. The the autonomous vehicle might have quicker reactions, be able to, you know, much more quickly analyze multiple variables, but might not be able to pick up on a longer distance, very subtle cue. Do you think that there is a way that at some point they could develop that sort of learned ability?
Well, I guess I question your premise that they can't do that. My first ride in a self-driving car was in Mountain View, California in 2011. I was on 101, headed north. I was in the center lane of a multiple-lane freeway. And keep in mind, this is 7 years ago, and my vehicle had a Volkswagen Beetle cut in front of it, and I realized that my self-driving car anticipated that that vehicle was going to cut in front of me and actually backed off on the speed a bit to create a gap so that vehicle could safely cut in front of me. The intuitive capability of the self-driving systems that are being developed are quite impressive.
That's a fairly easy intuitive play, though, that someone that you can tell someone is going to get over before they get over. I'm talking about much more subtle kinds of cues. You think
this was
they
very
have that
subtle? I was in the car. It was very subtle. I didn't see the car coming at all. So it's very, very impressive what the cars can do today. But you have to learn over 99.999% of what's going on in the real world of driving has to be understood and comprehended. And this has been a learning process, and great progress has been made. I don't want to leave your audience with the impression that everything has been discovered, but it's remarkable how much progress has been made and the promise of the technology.
We're talking with Lawrence Burns, former General Motors executive, longtime advisor to Google's self-driving car project, now dubbed Waymo. His new book, Autonomy, The Quest to Build the Driverless Car and How It Will Reshape Our World. If you have questions for him about the technology, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Lawrence, do you think ultimately we're going to end up with a kind of a merger here that as conventional vehicles develop more autonomous function, that we sort of just get, eased into a fully autonomous vehicle, or is it going to be a clear demarcation?
I think it's a clear demarcation. It's very, very difficult to ask someone who has been sitting in the driver's seat for 20 or 30 minutes not doing any driving tasks at all to suddenly take over when a situation surfaces that the car can't handle. Taking the driver totally out of the system is really the safest thing to do. In fact, I don't think we'll ever be safer than human-driven cars if we're continuing to rely on ourselves to do some of the driving. So I think it's a clear demarcation. These are truly driverless vehicles that there would be no driving requirement by the person at all when they're moving around.
On the ride-sharing front, how do you deal with the clog of the streets with driven ride-hailing services? We already got a problem in some urban areas because there's so many Uber and Lyft cars being driven around looking for fares that it's created much additional traffic. How could you potentially avoid that problem with driverless ride-hailing cars?
Well, if you have driverless ride-hailing cars, that means you're in the fleet business. You have a fleet of vehicles, and you're offering a transportation service, and your objective is to keep your cost per mile as low as possible. That's why these vehicles want to be electric vehicles, because the energy cost savings are significant. That's why you want to design them for a longer life. And another key part of making the cost per mile low is to have high utilization of your fleet. So the goal then would be to optimize the size of your fleet, understand your demand patterns, and have just the right number of vehicles on the roads and staged waiting to pick up people in order to provide fast, responsive, spontaneous service while making sure you have high fleet utilization.
And I guess I wonder how big that sweet spot is, because to serve the master of immediacy of response while at the same time not having the car out there clogging a parking spot or a street, how achievable is that realistically?
Very, very achievable. I led a program at Columbia University called the Program for Sustainable Mobility, and our research asked the question, I'll use Ann Arbor, Michigan as an example, but we asked this question for many other cities. If you could replace the personally owned cars. In the case of Ann Arbor, there were 200,000 personally owned cars in the city. With a shared fleet of electric driverless two-person vehicles, how many would you need? What kind of response times would you have to serve all the trips that people wanted to make? What would that cost? How highly would the fleet be utilized? How many miles are driven empty? And the results were stunning. About 15% of the cars that are in the Ann Arbor area, sort of on a daily basis, is all that you would need. In this case, it was 18,000 of the 120,000 vehicles that are really in Ann Arbor every day. 18,000 cars could replace those 120,000 and do what the 120,000 are doing. The problem with 120,000 cars is they're parked 90 to 95% of the time. These shared vehicles would be in motion, moving real people around most of the time. And the other remarkable finding was only about 5% of the miles that those vehicles drove were without a paying customer. So I think this is truly manageable because you're utilizing the cars in a much smarter, much more efficient way.
It is predicated, though, on everyone moving to that ride-hailing model that you're describing. Otherwise, you're still going to have some percentage of those privately owned vehicles there.
Well, no, it's not predicated on that. The Columbia Research indicated that if you served about 10% of the trips in a city like Ann Arbor, you would reach a scale where the business would work just fine. What I mean by that is going to 11% wouldn't really reduce the cost of your service any further. So you can get to scale economy at about 10%. But you raise an important point. The fact is, most of us like having our own vehicle. We go out and buy one, insure one, finance one, drive one, park one, refuel it. We put up with a lot of hassles to own our own car. And we're talking about a future where those experiences can be made much better with the autonomous driver at a much lower cost. So one would think you'd even have a greater tendency for people to want to have their own. But where it gets really interesting is, let's say you had your own driverless vehicle under your control, and you rode it to work, and it dropped you off at your door, and then you decide to dispatch it from work to go pick up your daughter who needs to go to soccer practice, and after she's delivered, it gets dispatched by you to pick up your wife to take her to her job, and then she dispatches it to pick up your mother-in-law to get her to Meals on Wheels, and later on it gets dispatched to pick up your dry cleaning. The point I'm making here is you could have an autonomous vehicle under your control that is used much more each day rather than sitting around parked, and as a result, you're probably not going to need that second or third car.
All right.
So I think there's going to be a very important role for dedicated use autonomous vehicles that have a driving service embedded in them with smart places to go and wait for you.
I'm enjoying our conversation. I got to take a break. We'll come back and continue with former GM top executive Lawrence D. Burns, longtime consultant with Google's self-driving car project, now Waymo, and his new book, Autonomy, The Quest to Build the Driverless Car and How It Will Reshape Our World. Back in just 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Our phone lines are open for you to talk with executive of GM for many years, Lawrence D. Burns, now consults with Google's self-driving car project known as Waymo, and his new book, Autonomy. We're at 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Jack in Zurich writes, what are self-driving car makers planning for the day when someone buys a car, decides to serve it himself, breaks out a laptop, plugs it in, downloads something from who knows where, and puts it in the car? You'll never be able to relax in your own self-driving vehicle because, you know, out there somewhere, that car with the program from some who knows what is going to create a horrible accident. Lawrence Burns, you want to respond?
Well, today, human drivers create horrible accidents at a pace of about 100 fatalities a day in the United States. So certainly one can sit and imagine scenarios where in the future crashes will occur. The whole objective here is to eliminate over 90% of the serious crashes that we see today, and this technology has that potential. You know, you have to have some controls over this. You have to have some standards to which these systems are being developed. You have to have some proof points that it can function safely and be robust with respect to the different scenarios that surface. And that's what's going on right now. Nobody has scaled the self-driving system to any extreme yet. It's at a very early stage where we're learning on public roads. And through that learning process, I think we're going to be able to end up at a point, not just with the technology, but the supporting regulations and the business responsibilities and liability responsibilities to mitigate the kind of concern that that question raises.
Speaking of serious crashes, you would know the figures much better than me, but my sense is that the majority of fatalities, the most serious crashes occur later at night, involve drinking drivers. Rural areas have a much higher per capita rate of fatal crashes. People are driving longer distances, often at higher speed. And I wonder, because certainly self-driving vehicles are not going to totally do away with serious injury or fatal crashes. Is it going to shift, though, the propensity where those happen? For example, you know your odds of, you know, where you're driving and when you're driving are much greater of something bad happening than in other times. Is that not going to be the case with self-driving vehicles?
I think it's a great observation that the risk associated with a serious crash varies considerably by where you are and the time that you're at those places and the circumstances that exist. And there's data out there that suggests that some stretches of the interstate are 10 times riskier than other stretches of the interstate, for example, just for those reasons. And this gives us an opportunity to take advantage of that insight. Take a simple situation of a school and the road in front of a school where we're all taught when school's in session, you have to slow down to below 25 miles an hour. A self-driving car system may not even take that road. It may be smart enough to avoid that route altogether because it's paying very careful attention to those risks. So the idea would be to pick a route that offers the greatest safety, not just for the occupants in the vehicle, but pedestrians and others who could be in the area. So I think what's going on with self-driving cars, as well as the massive amounts of data that we're now collecting around when the risks occur for crashes, I think it's all going to combine to make the system dramatically safer.
You come from one of the big American automakers, GM. What's the future for the major automakers, not just here, but Europe and Asia?
Well, they're going to have to change their business models considerably. In 2016, I looked at the profitability of every auto company. That's their annual net income, and divided it by the number of cars that they produced and sold worldwide. And turns out the companies range from about $1,000 of net income per car to $5,000. That's not very good profit for these companies. And if you have a self-driving car business and you're selling the miles rather than the vehicle, and you can make 10 cents a mile, which I think is very doable given the work I did at Columbia, and you have that vehicle for 300,000 miles, that's a $30,000 profit, not a $1,000 or $5,000. So part of the reason there's so much interest in this area by so many companies is this disruption provides great opportunities to shift the business model. And I think the auto companies are going to have to get positioned to do just that. And some of them are doing that. You mentioned General Motors. General Motors has invested in cruise automation. They've also developed a vehicle sharing program called Maven, and they have the Chevrolet Bolt as an all-electric vehicle, and they factory engineered it so you can install the autonomous system. So I think companies are starting to recognize a big change is coming.
Well, thank you.
They're going to have to pivot to a different way of doing business.
Lawrence Burns, appreciate your being with us. His new book, Autonomy, The Quest to Build the Driverless Car and How It Will Reshape Our World. It's Air Talk on KPCC Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. Have a great afternoon.